my kids listening to thousands, literally thousands of songs about heartbreak, rejection, pain, misery, and loss. Did I listen to pop music because I was miserable? Or was I miserable because I listened to pop music?
Well, music is my life, man. What do you want me to do?
There. Welcome to episode number 57 of Love That Album podcast, the first episode for 2014. Hope that all you people out there have had an enjoyable holiday season, no matter which side of the planet you're on. I know in the Northern Hemisphere, you people have been freezing your backsides off, and down here we've been boiling our bums off. But this is not a weather discussion podcast, it's a music discussion podcast. My name is Morris. And if you've been listening to the show before, welcome back. If this is your first time, welcome on board. Hope you enjoy it. And I'm very excited. I know I say that a lot, but I really am, because I'm joined by a newcomer. I always like to have, you know, people to discuss albums with me on this show. And I've got a first timer, though hopefully not last timer, for this episode. I am joined by one half of The Gentleman, a.k.a. The Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema, Mr. Will Smith from Canada. Good morning to you, Will.
Thank you, Morris. Good evening to you. It's really a pleasure and honor to be here. I was thrilled you asked me, and it certainly won't be the last time. As we all know, scheduling can be a bear, but we'll wrestle that bear.
Not to mention those damn international datelines. So it's 20 past 10 Saturday night, just a couple of hours before Australia Day, and it's 20 past 6 in the morning for you on Saturday. So as I like to say to my international guests, I have seen your future. I'd like to get someone from New Zealand on, because they're 2 hours ahead of us. So I'd like them to say to me, I have seen your future, but.
Yeah, tell me about it. Man, I'm glad I don't record with someone from New Zealand on a regular basis. That would be a logistical nightmare.
Yeah. Actually, I've got a very, very close friend who lives just outside of Christchurch in New Zealand, and I've been trying to talk to him for the longest time. What this man does not know about Elvis Costello is not worth knowing, but I can't seem to convince him to come on. He's very articulate and, you know, a wealth of information, but he sort of feels that, no, the podcast is not his place for conversation. So I respect that, but, you know, I'm hoping that someone else from New Zealand will step up to the plate. That'd be cool. But yeah, anyway, for the one or two listeners out there who don't know who you are, and I'm sure that, you know, a large chunk of the 10 or so listeners that I have will know who you are. But Will, for the few who don't, please explain The Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema.
Absolutely. It's a show that began, I would imagine, around 6 years ago with my partner in crime, Sammy. He's in Kentucky and as you said, Morris, I'm in Canada. Being someone who had a lot of time at work on my hands, not always wanting to listen to music, as blasphemous as that sounds on a music show, I wanted to indulge in sort of listening to film conversation. And I stumbled onto podcasts, and I discovered a few podcasts along the way, and I just felt like there was a lot of gaps in what was being discussed on podcasts. And my partner felt the same way. We were part of a message board, and we both had a mutual affection for sort of Charles Bronson and tough guy cinema of the 70s and samurai films and spaghetti westerns. And from there, and 80s, you know, 80s direct-to-video stuff. And we decided to have a voice for those kinds of films, and not just those kind of films, because we both feel that, or felt, and always feel, thankfully it's changed now, but and not because of us, certainly, but because of a large group of passionate people, that a lot of film was underrepresented, and you know, we didn't want to just be as myopic to think that we were only going to cover action films. We wanted to cover art house films from Belgium and direct-to-cable Andrew Stevens, Shannon Tweed films, if we saw fit. Sort of everything under the umbrella of midnight cinema, that is to say, things that didn't play in the market, the multiplexes, week in and week out.
And so this is like now 5 years or something like that.
We're coming up on 6 in September. It's really flown by. It's hard to believe that when we began, I didn't have any children. And I think episode 7 was when my oldest son of 2 sons was born. And it's astounding how quickly time goes. I don't have to tell you that, certainly. It seems to go faster the older I get.
Oh, yeah. I think in about a month, my son Max turns 16 and he's threatening to go for his driver's learning permit. And I'm thinking, hang on, you were just born yesterday. How did that happen?
But, yeah.
Oh, dearie me, I'm going to get all teary-eyed and sentimental, which is not a good thing on a podcast because it'll create gaps there. But anyway, the GGTMC has certainly been a big part of my weekly listening podcast pleasure. I remember it went about in a chain for me because I first came about to podcasts through the Mondo movie podcast. Mondo? The horror podcast in England.
Right. That was my first one too, actually.
Well, there you go. And, they split up for a time, or they had other projects to go on. So I thought, what am I going to do now? It didn't occur to me before that there are other podcasts out there. And then I discovered, while doing a search, I discovered our mutual friend Terry Frost's wonderful podcast, Paleo Cinema, and every week he had feedback from this strange character, Dr. Zom. And then I heard Dr. Zom had his own podcast, Silver and Gold, starting. So listen to that, and then through the chain, it was like a domino effect, and found my way to you guys. So we've had a lot of great listening pleasure, and I should make this known out there. I guess there's a few months ago, Will was very, very kind to allow me to indulge my love of film as well, and doing a musical film discussion with another lovely chap who I met on the Facebook board for the GGTMC, Rodrigo Obon. We both had this passion for jazz, and along with him and Love That Album and now See Here podcast regular Tim Merrill, we discussed a couple of great jazz films, Bird and Round Midnight, and that was just a thrill to be able to do that under the GGTMC banner. So we've been having this connection for a while now, so it's quite cool. But I'm really excited for you to be part of I Love That Album officially.
Oh, likewise.
So I guess at this stage we should probably say what it is that we're going to be discussing. Well, sort of when we discuss the albums properly, we'll say how we came across these. But we're going to be talking about an album from a British fellow of Ugandan descent, Mr. Michael Kiwanuka, and his album, I think now from 2012, called Home Again, and an album that you just put me onto about 2 months ago, your suggestion from a fellow Kanak, I believe, residing in Vancouver nowadays, called Mac DeMarco.
I think Montreal, actually.
Oh, really?
He's in Montreal, so...
Okay, yeah. But we got a lot to say, and his album of last year too, and only today I discovered, actually before you put that post up, I discovered a few hours ago that he's got a new album coming out in April, so we'll discuss a little bit about that too, no doubt. Home Again by Michael Kiwanuka, and Two by Mac DeMarco, and also another show regular, Mr. Eric Reanimator Peterson, is returning for 2014 with his wonderful segment, An Album I Love. And he's going to be talking about an R&B singer called Janelle Monáe. I'm sure no relation to Count de Monáe. but anyway, so he's talking about an album called The Arch Android, which he says is a concept album based on Metropolis, the film Metropolis. So keeping things cinematic here at Love That Album this time around. That'll be on a little bit later on in the show. So stick around. Well, it's a podcast, so no doubt you will stick around. That'll be a lovely thing. But I think what we'll do is we'll have a quick break, and then we'll come back after this podcast promo to discuss Michael Kiwanuka's album, Home Again. You're listening to Love That Album, episode 57, with Will in Toronto and Morris here in Melbourne. We'll be back shortly.
GGTMC live for you. Fresh, yeah! Big Willie and the Samurai are at your service, breaking films down and turning them around, giving recommendations that are always on point. Visit GGTMC.com for more information. The Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema, bringing class to the trash since 1977.
Trick-or-Treat Radio is a phantasmagorical spin kick straight through the heart of pop culture, navigated by the Deadites. We are the world's greatest electroshock band, we destroy monsters, we drink booze, and we win championship belts. If you're not listening to Trick-or-Treat Radio, here's a taste of what you've been missing.
There's three guarantees in life. What are they?
Death, taxes, and Trick-or-Treat Radio every Friday morning.
This is one of the most convoluted movies I've ever seen in my life.
I'm fucking trying, man.
Hey, hey, hey.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, hey, hey.
Oh, yeah.
It's like you took a shit on a pile of shit.
But you shit on him for liking what he likes.
Yeah, well, it's my job.
This podcast is now banned in Germany.
It's me, Giovanni Lombardo Ricci.
Shut up. I call bullshit. I demand someone to bring me the face of Lindsay Lohan.
If I had genitals, I would definitely bang her.
Oh, wait. Is she a great big fan person?
You just hit the jackpot.
This is a weird movie, huh?
It had action. It had suspense. It had great characters. It had great acting.
I'm going to strangle you with my jockey shorts.
I don't like mobster movies.
All right, well, here's my take. You're a sick fuck.
Thank you. Now shut the fuck up and let me talk.
Have you ever seen 2001?
The box, right? The box and the monkey.
Available on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and trickortreatradio.com.
Arrivederci, douchebags.
Here I am in Music City. It's my time to. Just this song, it doesn't fit me. Now I'm losing my mind. If only they told me.
Welcome back. You're listening to episode 57 of Love That Album. And we're going to start off. The first of our two albums for this show is Michael Kiwanuka's album called Home Again. Now, I guess I like to keep these shows in the last few episodes we've done two artists per show somewhat thematically linked, and I guess the loose link that I've made for this show is two songwriters who I'm looking forward to see what they do next. That sounds, I guess, a little bit broad, but they are, you know, still fairly young. And I think Michael Kiwanuka, I'm not sure, might be only like 24, 25 or something like that. And Mac DeMarco is, you know, similar age, so hopefully they've both got long careers ahead of them, and they've both sort of shot out the gates with, well, you know, spoiler alert, really great albums. But I'll be really interested, because I guess, do you sort of find, Will, that you've listened to any number of artists who've come out with like a really great album to start off with and sort of went a little bit helpless for album number two?
At times, you know, it's that inevitable thing you hear about in a myriad of disciplines, you know, the sophomore slump. Mm-hmm. It even gets into sports sometimes. Someone has a wonderful rookie year and then the sophomore slump kicks in. But yeah, it's always, and even with film, it's not as prevalent in film, but it's that thing of sometimes when someone makes their first album, there's so much that they've had on their chest and their hearts for, you know, years,
right,
potentially, and they're trying to put everything into that album. Just like when you see a first film, and apologies if I keep referring to film
please
in regards to this, but it's one of those things where they're trying to get every sort of influence and nod and passion into that album, or yeah, in this case, album. So sometimes how much gas they have left in the tank by the time they get to album two. But I think that, as you were saying, we have two young artists who clearly are talented musically. They can write, they play instruments, they have a pretty interesting way of having their albums arranged. So I'm hoping, as you'd said, that this is the start of something good for both of them.
The Mac DeMarco album, which we'll get to later, was recommended to me by you. But this first one was recommended to by our mutually great friend, Mr. Tim Merrill. So Home Again is, Michael Kiwanuka is, as I said, British of Ugandan heritage. And I was just really thrilled that Tim passed this on to me. We tend to have, you know, like a weekly Skype discussion. And he was saying to me sometime last year, 2012, we're in 2014, aren't we? He said to me sometime in 2012, man, there's this great soul singer I just know you're going to love. And, you know, he I can't remember what the song that he sent me a link to on YouTube was, but I was absolutely spellbound. And I know, funnily enough, though, that I've seen a few reviews online, and you know, I was really surprised to find that the praise that I had for him was not universal, but he had his share of detractors. We'll sort of get into more why some of that was, but I think a lot of people are in great favour of him. I want to ask, where was your first? Where did you first gain your attention to Michael? Because I know you put on a post on Facebook saying that you were, you know, it was a Michael Kiwanuka type of Sunday afternoon, and that's why I sort of jumped in it. All right, that's the show, that's the album we're going to discuss. But where did you first hear about Michael Kiwanuka?
Yeah, in this day and age, and I again outside of film, I pretend to refer to sports and my family. It seems to be the things that tend to dictate a lot of time that I have. I don't have as much time as I used to indulge in a lot of things I love, music being one of them. And what I've done is I've turned to some really great music blogs to kind of navigate the waters in terms of new music or older music. And I think I want to say, if I may, take about just a quick moment to get on a soapbox here and proclaim my love for this age we're in terms of being able to be exposed to things the world over. Some people lament the loss of days gone by. I think it's purely a silly nostalgic thing, because I can get online and I can find a blog that caters to African mixtapes of sort of disco and funk and music from that region of the world, or I can find stuff that's very specific to a taste I'm looking for, a taste I didn't even know I was looking for. So I really think we're in a beautiful, wonderful age to be able to consume music. And I'll talk about this later with Eric Reanimator's piece and how that, I think, shapes a lot of artists today. But I had discovered Michael through one of, I think, the best music blogs going, Aquarium Drunkard.
Okay. And I'll make a note of that one.
Wonderful. It is wonderful. It is very eclectic. I mean, he'll have everything from very obscure Dusty Springfield B-sides to newer music like Michael Kiwanuka. And I knew just from the album cover, it certainly evokes a time. It looks almost like a more pensive version of the cover of Marvin Gaye's seminal album, What's Going On.
Right, right.
A little bit moodier, a little darker in colors. It's like a brown cover. But I discovered him through that, and probably around the same time you did in 2012, and I've come back to him several times since, and I've been thankful for him. And yeah, I was kind of surprised to see there were a few detractors. Thankfully, yeah, as you'd said, praise is much more positive, because he's certainly well deserving of it. But that's how I'd come to him. I he posted some stuff on there, and I knew it was for me, because my background, for what it's worth, musically, does reside in soul and R&B and funk and sort of rock and roll. Like, I didn't really grow up in a household with a lot of folk, Paul Simon and Cat Stevens and Neil Young. All this stuff wasn't really in my day-to-day. It was Motown, it was Stax Records, right. It was Elvis, Johnny Cash, and that's the stuff that, as I've gotten older, I've kind of branched out from there. And I guess I'm taking a segue here, but
I'm feeling embarrassed that I didn't actually ask you in the first segment. That should have been one of the first things I asked you, was what your original music loves were. So no, please, I'm really interested to know. This is great.
Oh, right. Yeah, it was one of those things. My parents were big into Sam Cooke and Marvin Gaye and Elvis and
nice.
All that stuff, really. I mean, I would not call my parents audiophiles. It was more, it was on the radio and we'd listen to it. And they had quite an album collection, it should be said. A lot of British rock. They grew up in that time. My tastes tend to lean more towards the soul side of things. My mother, I got to give credit to both. I mean, James Brown was a big thing. Otis, like I said, Otis Redding and... It kind of blew me away, and again, because of the age we're in now, I've been able to branch out and sort of get into jazz, and like I said, trying to dabble my toe into the waters of African kind of funk and soul, and living in Toronto, it being very much a multicultural country, getting into reggae and older reggae, yeah, not to say there wasn't rock in my rock and roll proper. I have Stones, and again, but it tended to be more of the stuff like Zeppelin, Stone, stuff that was influenced by a lot of the African American musicians of the 40s and 50s. You know, your Chuck Berry's and what have you. Well, I got to give it up to Stevie Wonder. he's probably my favorite all time. So.
Yeah, interesting you mentioned Stevie Wonder. I recently went and bought this fantastic 4-CD box set of Donny Hathaway. And I'd always thought that Donny Hathaway sounded a lot like early 70s Stevie Wonder. And then I read in the booklet inside the box set that Stevie Wonder was a big fan and modeled himself after Donny Hathaway's vocal delivery. I always thought it would have been the other way around, but there you go.
Yeah, Donny, I think it preceded him, you know, roughly in terms of his career getting big, maybe 5, 6, 7 years. And he was a little, obviously a little bit older than Stevie. Stevie had been performing since he was very young.
Yeah.
Certainly. Yeah, but I mean, Stevie's influenced so many singers in this day and age. I mean, you're seeing that so much nowadays with sort of throwback artists, which I can be a bit wary of, truth be told. Like a lot of sort of neo-soul and what have you, which, you know, ties into Mr. Kiwanuka. A lot of it I'm very wary of because I feel like a lot of it's this sort of silly mini pops dress up. Let's put on our 70s corduroy suit and sound like Marvin or sound like Stevie. And
let's bring this up actually, because this is the first place I was going to go to. I was going to say, like, there are several factors at work on the album. And, you know, as you've gone and said, you know, in recent years, there's been a variety of bands or artists who've gone, you know, deliberately retro in the soul vein. So, you know, the big one that comes to mind for me is Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings, or really anyone on the Daptone label. You know, before that, tragically, you know, Amy Winehouse. But, you know, I guess, but even before the soul revival, there'd always been bands that had been deliberately paying their respects to, you know, the rock and roll or swing eras, you know, like the Stray Cats, the Royal Crown Review.
Brian Setzer Orchestra.
Brian Setzer Orchestra. And I guess maybe more in a rock soul cross vein, another great band that Tim Merrill put me onto called Vintage Trouble. They absolutely knocked me out. They were fantastic. I mean, certainly artists like that, I think it's more of a desire to recreate the great sounds that they'd heard in their parents' record collections rather than any desire to look hip. I've never doubted any of those people's sincerity. And really could also sort of look at it and say that, you know, outside of the rock and roll vein, you know, the more rootsy Americana style of artists have never gone away. There's never had to be a revival because country music has always been there. It's not like so-and-so is going to be the new Johnny Cash or the new June Carter Cash, because, you know, a lot of that sort of, I guess what they now call alt country, people have always been at that temple.
I was going to say that. Yeah, absolutely. There's been a very distinct, I don't want to say evolution, because for me it's been a bit backwards in terms of it's melded, I think, a little bit. It's married into sort of pop music, as it were. And I think that distinction, but you're seeing that with a lot of genres, I guess, with lines being crossed and being blurred. And yeah, I certainly understand what you're saying as far as some artists have a legitimately good intent to and are inspired by their parents' record collection. I feel like some, though, I think to me it's apparent the artists that dig deeper than just sort of the big sort of A-sides, because it's apparent in the way they've arranged their albums, and it doesn't sound like someone just whose heart may be in the right place, but is clearly aping a sound and a very specific, say, a song or an album sound or the Motown sound or you know, a certain kind of sound. I think I've seen certain artists, for example, Mayer Hawthorne, who I know our mutual friend Tim's a fan of. On the surface, some may dispose of him as just a, you know, blue-eyed soul singer, but being pretty familiar with soul music, I got to give it up to him. He knows his stuff, and hearing some of his arrangements and his songs and what have you, and it harkens certainly to some deeper cuts from Isaac Hayes, or even some of the Washington soul sound or Philadelphia soul with some of his lush arrangements. So he's someone that clearly is, as much like Mr. Kiwanuka today, has a very deep understanding of the genre and makes it, and it's probably a term that gets overused, but makes it his own, which I think is the key, is to have a fresh, organic sound. Well, if you are still hearkening to the greats, you can make it your own.
The thing is, I think I remember reading somewhere that, you know, growing up, he wasn't really into soul music. It was maybe like only in the last few years. I'm not sure if he was a folkie or maybe he'd just been, you know, a London kid who'd been, rocking out, you know. But I think, I don't know what it was that someone played him, but it really deeply affected him. And he said, right, this is the way I want to go. But once again, because something about the music touched him rather than any great commercial considerations.
Sure.
So, I mean, we'll probably touch on this because more about, because what you've been saying there about artists, who might be aping a style. And I guess some of Kiwanuka's detractors have said that he hasn't yet found his own style because he is relying too much on, what do they say, standing on the shoulders of giants. And yet, whilst I can see that there are moments on this album which I see who the influence is there, but I don't necessarily see that as a bad thing, because by and large, he's not so much it's not just about being a sound stylist. You need to be a great songwriter. And what I love about this album is he has songwriting talent in abundance.
Close your eyes, let them rest. I ain't in no hurry at all. Rest your on my shoulder, and I swear I would carry you, but I won't let you go.
YouTube, I think, earlier today, and I saw like there was like a 45-50 minute set he was doing, I can't remember where, but he was playing with a fairly basic sort of four-piece band, drums, bass, guitar, lead guitar, and himself on acoustic, and it sounded a lot rawer than the arrangements, which are, sort of like, you've got beautiful string arrangements and all that sort of thing on this album, but the songs, they hold up, but in a very different way. And that's what I think his great strength, well, one of his great strengths is the songwriting. I guess it could be fairly said that, it both from the perspective of the arrangements that you get on this album and the very much in the production, this does sound like an early 70s album, something that's just sort of been dusted off and found and brought to public attention.
Yeah, it does, but again, it sounds very sincere and organic. And it's the thing I like about it is it doesn't feel digital, it doesn't feel like this very clearly sort of intent to. I mean, like you said, I think they're very, to me, the big influence and that I took away from listening to them, and I think it's partially because there weren't a lot of guys who had the same sound, but to me, I took away sort of a Bill Withers, a slightly more melancholic Bill Withers.
Because
he's an African-American artist who plays a guitar, has a sensitive side, talked about some things that weren't always were more sort of off the beaten path in terms of the way they approached love and loss compared to some other contemporaries.
Right.
Now, I know that, to be completely transparent, one of the other big names that comes up in terms of Kiwanuka and sounds is Terry Collier, who I only have a passing knowledge of, but I have to say that is spot on. I can't connect the dots as much as I could with Withers. I'm a huge Bill Withers fan. I think he's
right.
Kind of gets lost in the shuffle, sadly, and he stepped away to sort of produce more as he got older. But Kiwanuka's album and his songwriting, like you said, it's an interesting approach. It's a very earnest approach, and I think that it's all the better for that, because it kind of goes off the beaten path. But I'm also very taken by the fact that his sound, despite sounding a little bit like those guys, is, to me, as a North American and a fan of soul music, it feels very different. It feels very British at times in some of his arrangements, and they're a little more eclectic, and I like that, because I think that not enough artists are taking chances, and that kind of comes around again to that thing of being in a digital age where he can get into a lot of folk music, and he could get into soul, and he could marry the two, and he could add very much a European sensibility, and sort of some of the woodwind stuff he uses on the album is really impressive, and it's something that you don't see a lot with a lot of soul or quote-unquote soul or neo-soul artists.
Right, well, okay, so the artists who I guess that came to my mind, and it's more from the arrangement. So like when you hear a song like Tell Me a Tale, it sounds like early 70s Van Morrison. You know, it's those the horn sections, the flute that you get in a song like I'll Get Along, and that sort of not quite big band, but that sort of what they used to call, I guess, you know, he dubbed Caledonian soul. It has that sort of feel that in circa 1971, 72, 73, those early Warner Brothers albums, and you know, maybe some of the early Polydor albums from Van Morrison. It's very much to me in that vein. But one, influence that I hadn't seen anyone make a comparison to, and it seemed to me really very obvious, was I Won't Lie. Sounds like it belonged on Pet Sounds by the Beach Boys.
Oh, comfort me, brother. Something's heavy on my mind. Now I sit and wonder why it is that I can't find. All on my own, can't seem to get there on and on. So come, hear me, brother. I won't. Now I have been broken. No.
Because you've got the string arrangements, and you've got the timpani, and it sounds like he's been listening to I Just Wasn't Made for These Times. And he's not stealing a melody, he's not stealing an arrangement or anything, it's not stealing, but he's obviously listened to this album and thinks, wow, that's really, really cool. Wonder if I can incorporate that. And that's, I don't see that as a crime, the same way that a lot of these, music reviewers, the cooler than thou music reviewers, see him. I just see, wow, that's a beautiful song, and he's taking every little influence that's on his palette. You'd be stupid to listen to that and say, right, that's already been done. I can't do that. You just because someone's done, taken a specific shade of red in a painting doesn't mean you're never going to do that. And he's taken these things and he's brought them in. There's even like the clip-clop in that song, I Won't Lie, that you hear on God Only Knows. I mean, it's beautiful. It works. It's like, thank you, Brian. I'd want to use that. And I imagine Brian Wilson would listen to that, and he'd probably, I imagine if he's heard Michael Kiwanuka, I imagine he's a fan. And I even said, like on that song Bones, which we'll talk a little bit about further on, it reminds me of Sam Cooke. You hear the harmony vocals in the background, and it sounds really like a Sam Cooke and the Soul Stirrers song.
Yeah, he sounds to me, because I came up, like I was saying, with Sam Cooke and Otis writing at the same time, despite having very different styles. I tend to associate them together. And I actually found more of like a vulnerable, quiet Otis writing. He wasn't as, Sam, I think, had a tighter production. His sound was a little bit tighter than Otis was, a bit looser in terms of his sound. I feel like I definitely see Otis in his music. But yeah, spot on with Van Morrison. It's something else I forgot to mention. I did definitely get a Van Morrison feel, but I can't convey enough how much I appreciate how eclectic the album feels. And it has a really you know, some albums and some artists are able to evoke a certain feeling, a certain time of year, a certain emotion. And this album, to me, feels very outdoorsy. It feels very much like an autumn album. Like, this album, to me, it evokes sort of lying, you know, on a Sunday afternoon in the autumn, looking at the trees with this a warm sun ray coming down on me. And that may sound a bit hippy dippy, but I really feel like it does convey that.
I got to say, Will Smith, I like the way how you think, because I wasn't actually going to say that about this album, but when we get to Mac DeMarco, I also have a seasonal memory association. I mean, I've only heard his music the last couple of months, but the sound of that album reminds me very much of summer. But I'll go into that later on. But it's interesting. Right. Wow, I don't think I've ever had anyone on the show sort of tell me that music reminded them of a season or a time and place. And that's, and on the same show, I was going to make that reference you do too. Man, you got to keep coming on this show. This is great. I wanted to move to talk a little about the lyrical themes that he covers on this show. So he might only be like 24, 25 years old, which is really like a pup in musical terms, and, you know, hopefully with his great future ahead. Yet thematically, he sounds like a really old soul with his subject matter. He's not, he doesn't sing about young man angst or political disenchantment, which I guess can be a young person's subject matter as well. Or, you know, he's not singing about sex. He's singing about dealing with a lot of heavy emotional and spiritual loads and his belief and disappointment with God. I mean, he never mentions, you know, God as an entity, and does this without this sounding like it's a gospel album per se. It's not an album about proselytizing or preaching the word or, you know, repent and avoid the fires of hell. It's really a far more personal effort than that. And it's a good thing, because it doesn't mean what side of the divide, the religious divide, you fall. You know, you're a devout religious person or you're a hardline atheist. The themes of the album of hope and disappointment still can reach out and touch you. In fact, I mean, some of the religious references, by virtue, I guess, of his delivery, could be missed entirely, but I still think that they're definitely there. It's an album about his personal faith rather than saying, you should follow how I follow. It's just, this is what this means to me.
It's very funny you say that, because it is something that kind of does fly under the radar. I've listened to this album a number of times, and it wasn't until I sat down to analyze the album critically, because a lot of times with any art, it's the emotional response. And I think with a lot of albums, I don't tend to analyze too much unless I'll pick up a line. I'll think, oh, that's very smart writing. That's very coy. Or that's kind of a bit of a subversive day, this or that. But Kiwanuka, I was really taken when I listened to the album this time and really was listening to what he was saying. Not to say I wasn't before, but really listening this time to what he was saying. And I was really taken by how much a spiritual album this is and how much he does talk about faith and God. Like you said, without banging you over the head with it, because it's not a gospel album or it's not any of those things, but how much it looks at faith, and it's a very wistful album, and it does come from a very personal place for him, and a lot of, you know, religious themes of hope and universal themes, really, like hope and love, and there's a certain restlessness to his album, and of trying to find oneself, and, you know, talks about literally and figuratively kind of wandering in the album, which of course does tie into faith again.
Yes.
Tell me a tale that always was. Sing me a song that I'll always hear. Tell me a story that I can read. Tell me a story that I believe. Paint me a picture that I can see. Give me a touch that I can feel. Around so I can be everything I was meant to be. Lord, I need loving. Lord, I need good, good loving. Lord, I need loving.
The opening song on the album, Tell Me a Tale, which is the most Van Morrison-like song on the album.
Yes.
He sings, tell me a tale that always was, sing me a song I'll always be in, tell me a story that I can read, tell me a story that I can believe. And really, that is, I mean, there are other points on the album, but there you go, right off the bat, his statement of intent. This is his plea to faith in his personal belief system. It's, once again, it's not a call to arms or to proselytize. And what makes this work in a modern context is that we don't have the gospel Hammond organ. Not that I have a problem with that, because I'll listen to Mahalia Jackson till the cows come home. You know, it's not that staple of the old time church tunes. This is not about a retro sound in that line, but it's probably appropriate that the sound is more like Van Morrison. So you get that, what you call that spiritual restlessness in that more personal line, and you know, when that Astral Weeks flute comes in, you're just sold. And you know, the production here, it's not just about the arrangements, not just about his own vocal sound. Paul Butler, I think, who produced the album, really, he wanted it to sound like an early 70s album, and yet it never sounds like a pastiche.
Mm-hmm.
So he's pursuing these older themes that might be ignored by a lot of modern songwriters. Still, but you know, everything, the production work and the lyrical themes and the music, it all ties in really, really well. It's all sympathetic. Is it right? These are the lyrics I want to convey. Okay, we'll present the arrangements and the production appropriately, rather than sort of trying to go at odds with it.
Yeah, it does. And the thing of it is, everything works organically, from his sound, which is organic, to the way it was produced and the arrangements and his songwriting and his voice. Everything is very, very organic. And I did want to say, there's only one moment in the whole album, and it's on the final track of the album, where he walks beside me.
Yep.
That I thought, and my ear, certainly Morris is nowhere near as strange as yours, but I even wrote it down, that there's a brief Hammond organ note at the end.
Actually, no, I think you're right. But like everything else on the album, I hadn't ever thought about it like this, and this might consider, you know, sacrilege, but I mean, one of my favorite films is Alan Parker's The Commitments. And, you know, there's this moment where Joey the Lips Fagan is talking to he's mentoring his young protege, and he's explaining to him, you know, about soul is about restraint. It's not about doing solos all over the place. It's about having a defined roundness. And, you know, basically the message I'm taking out of it is keeping it restrained, not going all the places. It's not about the you, it's about the us. And, you know, look, it's a film I love. I know it's not everyone, you know, feels the same way I do about that, but certainly really he encompasses there for me what great soul and original soul is all about. And, you know, these musicians, they're sympathetic to Kiwanuka's songs. They're simple songs of faith, and there's no one instrument that's trying to take off and do some incredible solo. It's about everyone working together to produce this one vision.
Well, that comes back to that thing we talked about of the term old soul, and his maturity and his restraint. Butler's restraint is, again, how many first albums, you know, feature this, you know, this shredding guitar or this sax? I mean, whatever it is, there's always seems to be these moments where they have to have a showcase moment for an instrument or for the voice. And Michael Kiwanuka stays within a very specific range when he sings. Now, that could be because of that's where he's most comfortable, but it also could be that by his very nature, he's not showy enough to go on a run. Do you know what I mean?
And,
he sticks very much in a certain amount of restraint when he's working. But yeah, I think it comes to, again, the term soul, as obvious as this sounds, but a lot of this stuff comes from introspection and inside his soul that he's getting out, you know, to talk about what you were saying about with the line on the commitments, and that he's in turn giving to us is a lot of the stuff that's been internalized. And I feel like, yeah, just again, someone who's been looking for something, is trying to find something and is wrestling with a lot inside. And yeah, again, is very introspective.
And that's a good thing that sort of like links all soul music, I guess, is, you know, what you say, you hit the nail right on the head, I think, you know, with, about it being introspective, because, you know, you were making the comparison before, you're talking about, you know, difference between, say, Motown's description of Soul, you know, what was coming out of Detroit, for what was happening in Philadelphia, to what was happening in Alabama with Muscle Shoals, to what was happening in Memphis with Stax. So actually, at the moment, I'm reading a fantastic book called Respect Yourself about the history of Stax Records. And a few weeks ago, I went to see the documentary Muscle Shoals about the Fame Studios down there. Go on.
So I was going to say, I'm really pumped to see that documentary.
Oh, you haven't seen it yet?
No.
Oh, man, you'll really have a time with it. I mean, I guess, you know, like music documentaries, you can get some really, really fantastic ones, as I'm going to find out in my new podcast, which I'll plug later on in the show. But, you know, you can get some which really convey a great sense of what the musician or musical artist under subject is about. And there are some which are just fluff pieces, but Muscle Shoals just came out of it really, really exhilarated. And I think came home, I went with Max, and I went on Skype later on at about 10 o'clock at night and got to speak to Tim about it, who'd already seen it. And we spoke for about an hour, hour and a half, just about the film. And I thought, why wasn't I recording that? You know, we had a podcast right there and then, but it was just a personal conversation. But you fit the nail on the head there about Soul being introspection, because, you know, Kiwanuka's version of Soul is, you know, not Sam and Dave's version of Soul. And it's, you know, not necessarily what contemporary, when I say contemporary Soul, I'm talking about, like, you know, modern artists who are doing a style of soul that is not retro, like what, you know, the aforementioned artists are covering. I mean, you know, contemporary stylistically, not contemporary people who are just, you know, around now. I was going to say, I mentioned briefly before about another, you know, very retro sounding touch on the album was Bones.
Honey, I've been thinking about all that you do. Don't you think of me too? Lady, where you been for so long? I don't mean you no more. Had to write you this song. Well, I know. I guess I would leave this world alone. Without you, I'm just
well, we've already, you know, sort of spoken about the use of subtle touches on the album. And on this song, we get this very 50s background vocal, sort of like, you know, the Jordanaires, who you might have heard, you know, right, like under the old Elvis songs. And it just fits the song so beautifully. I mean, look, I'm a huge fan of, you know, groups like, you know, the Blind Boys of Alabama or the Fairfield Four or the Holmes Brothers, but none of the music here dictates a need for anything that's fire and brimstone like those singers were, who, as I said, absolutely adored, but the right tools for the right job and the gentle sound that they provide to Kiwanuka's sound on that song Bones is just absolutely perfect to my way of thinking.
Yeah, agreed.
Any what are the, like, are there any sort of musical touches that really impressed you? Because, you know, I know you've made notes about, you know, a whole bunch of songs specifically, but was there anything overall that sort of struck you, like, you know, that was a common theme throughout the album musically?
Well, I did want to actually talk about Bones for a sec. I'm glad you brought it up, because that's the track to me that is the most playful on the album.
Yes,
it has sort of the sunniest, most sunny disposition on the album. It's the one where he goes into, like, the quiet son of Otis in some ways, because he almost has this playful kind of back and forth yearning, like Otis used to do, and, you know, I love you, I can't live without you, and you drive me mad, and you drive me wild, and it's where we also hear, which is sprinkled throughout the album too, is a bit of a bluesy sound at times. It's not overt, again, nothing. It's never like he's just, you know, pouring it, you know, a bottle of ketchup on a plate. Everything is just right, just enough, and it's very much a plan that, because the rest of the, and I think he's smart to pepper a few songs on the album that are a little bit more uplifting, because as much as I love his sound, I do feel like the album, you have to be sort of in a specific state of mind, and it's not an album I can just throw on at any time of the day. That's not a criticism of the album. I just think some albums and some films work better in a specific setting, or you know, to enhance the viewing or the listening. And Kee Vanuka is wise to sprinkle songs like Bones on the album, because otherwise, I think you do start to, it starts to kind of drone on a little bit, as good as it is, but it perks things back up and then allows us to ease back into some of the more melancholic stuff that he does. But in terms of a few things I really liked, as far as on the album, some of the musical stuff, I think Any Day Will Do Fine.
Hey, listen, girl, can I get along with you? I'm in need of your time. Any day will be fine. Hey, listen, girl, an hour or two will do. Just be gentle and kind. Really be easy in my mind. My trouble upon ya, there where you lay, they'll never know, for I'm never sure. Your time will afford ya my cup.
I thought I heard that it sounds sort of like a Spanish guitar, or like an old very much almost like an old country guitar kind of slidey sound,
yeah,
at times. And and again, that track's a little more playful comparatively speaking to some on the album.
We've already spoken a little bit about Kiwanuka's voice. So one thing that I really like about Paul Butler's approach to production, and I don't know whether you sort of felt the same way about this, I mean, a lot of the time when you listen to an album where the focus is the singer as opposed to being a band, the singer's voice will be right up in front of the mix. And I guess, in proper bands as well, you know, where the lead singer is going to be the face of that band. But it seems to me that Butler, and quite wisely too, has gone and made Kiwanuka's voice almost like an instrument, so it blends in with the rest of the music. It's almost like saying, right, you know, Michael, your voice is going to serve your song the same way the flute, and the same way, I'm pretty sure there's a sitar, one of the songs is there as well.
Didn't catch that.
I'll Get Along, yeah, I'll Get Along, I'm pretty sure there's a sitar in there somewhere.
I know sometimes I wonder, sometimes I take too long, but I know where I'm heading. I know I belong. I didn't come, but I'll be alone in a little while. No songs when I don't call, I still get low in a little while.
But anyway, it seems to me that he's using Michael's voice as an instrument. It blends in. It's not up in front in the mix, and I really like that. And Kiwanuka's voice, it's something that I really appreciate. I mean, because you made the Otis comparison before, which I wouldn't necessarily see that, not in terms of timbre or vocal delivery, but what I really appreciate about his delivery is it's restrained, and yet it's the dynamic is never dull. You know, for me, I never get a sense of sameness, like, oh yeah, more the same, come on, let loose here. I think, no, I really like what I'm hearing. It's not a lazy sort of restraint. No. And one thing which I really love is not so much what he does as what he doesn't do. I only heard the word melisma maybe about 3-4 years ago, but I'd long known of the concept, and it's a concept, it's a vocal delivery that I hate, where singers, especially, you know, some of the more show-offy ones of the 1980s, 1990s, your Michael fucking Boltons, your Mariah Carey.
Carey comes to mind.
The guy with that... He's still got an emotional vocal. He's the one who's showing you here you can give emotion without sort of feeling like you've got to be all over the place. This is, I'm not showing off my vocal range here. I'm showing off this great song I've written. And that's something I love.
Morris, sorry to cut you. Morris, you're so spot on. You're so spot on, because this ties in with my sentiment. What I was going to chime in with next is that the way the album is put together, there's no vanity with Kiwanuka. He's there to serve the music. Yep. Without being sort of the face in the front all the time. He's happy to let it blend in versus him stand out in front. And I find it appalling to my ears to hear these singers. Like I do quite like Mariah Carey. She's very talented, but in saying that, you know, you look at singers like Christina Aguilera, and I was really struck by this around Christmas. It was a Christmas standard. I can't remember what it was now, and I want to say it was Christina Aguilera, and if not, it was an artist who was aping her. But they went on all these runs, and it's like, okay, this is the height of musical vanity. Yes. I know you can sing. I know you can sing. You don't need, it's like, you know, it's like you have lemonade and you dump the whole bag of sugar in. It's too much.
Right. Oh. Man. But no, that's something that you sort of saying show off and Michael Kiwanuka, not in the same sentence.
No.
Oh, gosh. One singer-songwriter who musically, stylistically, I wouldn't necessarily compare him to, but both in terms of really restrained but beautiful vocal delivery, is a guy called Nick Drake. Are you familiar with Nick Drake?
Mm-hmm. And passingly, so is that even a word, passingly? In a sort of a passing way.
Sure. So, you know, Nick Drake came up with, I think, like in his lifetime, maybe about 3 albums. There's been, you know, I think another, you know, 1 or 2 albums, certainly, you know, live album, and there's been maybe 1 or 2 albums of posthumously previously unreleased material. But really, these are albums of great beauty, and his vocal delivery was, you know, restrained but still very emotional. And even though Kiwanuka's voice is nothing like Nick Drake's, but his approach to the song reminds me very much of Nick Drake. I think I had a few more notes here, but I think possibly with, you know, I know that you've got to be up and start the day with your family. So unless did you have any more things? Oh, you have to go to work. Oh, well, there you go.
Well, you know, and I have to perpetuate the Canadian myth. It's actually a bit of a blizzard outside, and I got an hour commute with no snow, so it'll be a lengthy commute today. I guess overall thoughts, you know, it's nice to see. Yeah, I'll get on my soapbox again because it ties into my thoughts on the album.
Sure.
I think, you know, you would never proclaim this, Morris, but I've heard a lot of people proclaim, oh, man, there's no good new music. New music sucks, man. It's terrible. And I think to people, you know, shame on you when you have the internet at your disposal. And if you have a passion to seek something out, you can do so. And there's a lot of really great musicians making great music nowadays. Just like there's a lot of great filmmakers making great films today, but you have to dig beyond your HMVs and your multiplexes and your,
right,
your Apple hit list. Of course you do. And of course that stuff all sounds the same, but throughout time, a lot of that stuff sounded the same. And maybe top 40 music has devolved and become this shrill vein auto-tune, horror show, but there's wonderful musicians like Michael Kiwanuka who are putting together great albums and are influenced by, they're sort of kindred spirit. He's a kindred spirit to a lot of the artists that we've been mentioning as we've been talking about the album. But I'm really excited to see what he does next. And he's a guy that, because he doesn't clearly stamp himself as this kind of artist, or, you know, he doesn't make party like a, You know, he's not like a party album kind of guy. No. He has a wide net with which he can cast where he's going to go, whether it's a little more folky on the next, a little more soul, a little more jazzy. Because he actually played, and I didn't find this out until a few days ago, he played the Montreal Jazz Festival a few years ago.
Oh,
I would love to have been there. I would have loved to have seen him.
Oh, man. I've got to go back. I went there in 96 and had the time of my life. That's such a great festival.
Yeah, my favorite city for sure. But it's I think I love that he, I don't want to say by design because it sounds calculated, because I think that's from a very, very sincere place. But through what he loves, he casts a wide enough net that we're not going to get the sort of derivative same old with Kiwanuka's next album. So I'm excited to see where he goes.
I'm definitely looking forward to that. And I'm sort of hoping that what I saw on this live video on YouTube today might be the direction that he takes, that he does an album with just a band of, you know, drums, guitar, bass, and lead guitar. Not because what he did before was wrong. It's so perfectly right. But a songwriter like him, I think, will see evolve and try different things and, you know, prove those critics wrong. You know, I think he's a guy with a great future. I'm really looking forward to it. The favorite song?
Favorite song is I'll Get Along.
Nice. Yep. That's
like it. Number three on the album.
Yeah, that is a good one. I'd say probably my two favorites. I'm Getting Ready. A nice sort of acoustic, or jazz brush drum feel. I Won't Lie. That's, you know, the one I mentioned about before that, has that Beach Boys feel and just sounds like it belongs on Pet Sounds. But, overall, really, really strong album. Thanks so much, Tim, for putting me onto that. So, all right. At this stage, what we're going to do is go to, our good friend Eric Reanimator's segment, An Album I Love, and he'll be talking about Janelle Monáe and her album, The Arch Android. And I had a listen to his segment. And she's something of a contemporary soul singer herself, and only just found out she was here. And when Eric described it, I thought, oh, I wonder if she's, you know, like obscure or how. But, you know, she's apparently had all these Grammy nominations, and she performed with a huge band. I saw a video clip performing 2 years ago at the Sydney Opera House. So I don't think she's that obscure, but I just, you know, I'm not paying attention enough. I'm getting old. So anyway, we'll be back in a few minutes after Eric's segment, and we'll be talking about Mac DeMarco and his album 2. You're listening to Love That Album with Morris and Will. Speak to you shortly.
Take it away, Eric, the orchestra leader.
1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4.
Now it's time for An Album I Love with Eric Reanimator.
A la dee dee, a 1, 2, 3, Eric the
Reanimator.
Greetings and happy 2014. It's Eric Reanimator here with another album that I love. This time around, we're going to be talking about Janelle Monáe and her 2010 album, The Arch Android. Morris told me that the albums for this episode were tied together by the theme of young songwriters who we want to hear more from and see what they do in the future. And he also mentioned that one of them had a kind of retro soul element. My first thought was to cover the Bel Rays' Grand Fury album, but after giving that a listen and realizing that the Bel Rays have been around for quite a while, I started hunting through my music collection for something else, and I settled on Janelle Monáe. The Arch Android is her debut album, and it is a semi-concept album inspired by the film Metropolis. Throughout the record, she plays around with a lot of different genres, with soul music, with dance music, a little bit of disco. Don't tell anybody that I actually listen to that occasionally. And, of course, you can't have a retro science fiction album without having some 1930s, 1940s style crooning going on. There's a lot of different sounds on this album, but they all come from the same voice and the same editorial voice, I guess is what I'm saying. It's hard for me to pick favorite songs because as an album, it works so much better than just its pieces, even though they are so different at times. David Bowie is what comes to mind when I think of this album. I think 1970s David Bowie, that glam period, Ziggy Stardust. There's some of the DNA of that in this. And I also appreciate the fact that because this is a neo-soul hip-hop album, that it's bringing these sounds to an audience that doesn't usually hear crooning or psychedelic or kind of punky stuff. And also, since this really isn't a singles album, it's an album that requires you to sit down and listen to it, to play it in its entirety. I guess you could say it has a very 70s feel to it as an album. Now, Janelle Monáe does have a new record that came out at the end of last year. I have yet to check it out, but I will be in the very, very near future. So let's check out a little bit more of the record, and I'll catch you on the flip side.
I hope that I'll get to see you again. La-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. My friend, I hear the colors and the flowers. Snuffed at dawn. You're here, you're near, you're there, and then you're gone. La da 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 da.
Man, working all day on tunes. I just need some pussy.
Thanks very much, Eric, for another great segment, and he'll be back on Love That Album 58. I don't know what he's going to cover yet, but I wouldn't give it away even if I did, because that's part of the surprise. But I will tell you at the end of the show what who my partners are for the next program and what we're going to be discussing. But back to this show. And the second album for today is Mac DeMarco and his album 2. So, Will, when you agreed to come on the program to discuss Michael Kiwanuka, I asked, you know, what would be a suitable partner or just something else that you wanted to cover. And before I cover my reaction, just give me a bit of a brief background on how you actually discovered Mac. I mean, is he big over in Canada or big, like, you know, do you hear a lot about him in Toronto or what's the general reaction to him? How did you discover him?
I kind of discovered him again through the wonders of the internet. I had discovered him through, I want to say, a musical blog. I hate to sound like I'm, you know, looking to sources. I don't find anything on my own, but I don't.
Nowadays, it's as good a source as any. You know, we used to do it by the radio. Now we do it by a blog. It's as good a source as any, I think.
Yeah, and I'd heard something, and the thing that struck me was it would just admittedly, and I think by design, his very ridiculous album cover for 2, which is overtly kind of goofy, earnest. And I'd heard a few songs. I really liked them. And I forgot about them for a bit. And a good friend of mine, Paul Hughes, one of the finest Mancunians in the land, brought him back up.
And the man who says, Refife.
Yeah, that's right. Refife. Exactly. So he had posted something, I believe in Feed My Ears, and I'd come back to Mac because I was listening here again. It comes back to Aquarium Drunkard. I had come back to Mac because there was a cover. There's a great thing called the Lanyap sessions that they do on there where he takes artists that he likes and they cover more prominent material in some ways. And they talk about, you know, their approach to it and what have you. And Nightbeds had covered My Kind of Woman, which is, you know, truth be told, my favorite track on the album. Me to go back and listen to the rest of the album outside of a few tracks I'd listened to, and you know, him being a Canadian artist, I always try to support Canadian artists. I think of a pretty great music scene, you know, between, you know, bands like Arcade Fire and Metric and just a myriad of artists that have come out, and I wanted to kind of really support him, and he had a sound that was, you know, a sound that I liked as far as sort of pop rock, with just kind of this jangly kind of indie garagey kind of rock lo-fi. It's kind of a unique sound in a lot of ways. I like the OCs, which have a bit of a psychedelic garage kind of sound like he does, but his is very, very unique to him for me. And as we talked about off the air, I found it hard to articulate some of this, but that's kind of how I came to Mac, was just online and digging in. And it's truth be told, it was my favorite album last year. And I think I may have mentioned that on your year-end show.
Front
to back, and listen.
That's right, you did. When we spoke about this, and I asked you, right, who do you want to talk about, and you mentioned Mac DeMarco. And so I thought, all right, okay, I'll go do a bit of a search and find out who this guy is. I'd never heard of him. And the first thing I saw was this YouTube clip for this song, Ode to Viceroy. Now, I'll talk a little bit more about that later on, but I thought, this is crazy. We got this guy who's done almost like a love song, or is it a piss take? A love song to cigarettes. Okay, this is interesting. Let's see where he goes. And then I did a Google search to try and discover, you know, what is it about this guy's background. And the first thing that came up was, you know, Mac DeMarco, Melbourne 2013. I thought, oh, has he been here? And then I discovered he was going to be performing two nights after our discussion. He was playing here in Melbourne in a venue on the other side of town, and I couldn't make it. But there I was sort of astounded, thinking, oh, I wonder if this is just like some obscure indie guy. And I thought, well, no, he's playing on the other side of the planet in what turned out to be, when I read the reviews later, a sold-out gig to, you know, a whole bunch of very enthusiastic people. Anyway, I just sort of found that was an amazing thing. You know, there we go discussing it, and found, well, he's in my town. That's incredible. So I you know, did a little bit of research just to find out about his background. And, you know, like I guess a lot of artists, he'd gone and spent a lot of his time in previous years playing to near empty clubs. But, you know, fortunately for him, you know, the reviews and the word of mouth got him doing, you know, eventually sold out shows in Europe and apparently in California because of PR for his early album Rock and Roll Nightclub, where he wore lipstick and dressed in drag. He apparently earned a large gay following, and at a London show, some fellow broke through the security to plant a big wet one on the bass player's lips, which to me, first thing I thought, wow, you know, Mac DeMarco would, you know, do very well playing the theme for Silver and Gold. You know, they that's a very Silver and Gold thing. And I noticed that you went and put on Facebook today a link to the Some Kind of Woman clip. that is something else. That sort of you know, recalls to mind, you know, probably that whole thing. And there he's dressing in drag and putting on the lipstick. And the first thing I thought of, actually, when I saw the clip, like the first few seconds of it, it reminded me of Silence of the Lambs, where, you know, the
right,
Jamie Gunn character, you see the close-up of him doing the lips, and he steps back at himself to look at himself in the mirror. I thought, oh my God, is this going to go there? And fortunately, it didn't.
Thankfully, yeah, thankfully we don't see Mac DeMarco's tuck game.
I was thinking the same thing, man. The thing for me about this album is the sound. I find I'm often repelled by big-sounding records, and you've already gone and mentioned that this is a very lo-fi album. And I have a soft spot. I mean, obviously the music's got to be great, but I'm a really big fan of a good lo-fi sounding album. This does sound like it's, you know, recorded in a bedroom somewhere, but that's not, I don't mean that in a bad way. It's just.
Oh, Morris, you got a good ear, my friend. He recorded it in his Montreal apartment bedroom in his underwear.
Oh, there's well a silver and gold element. So basically, I can just imagine we ought to get, you know, I mean, I know Sly Stallone has been calling into Silver and Gold, but, you know, Mac DeMarco should be calling in. Hey, Silver and Gold, I got this guy, Mac DeMarco. He's doing a workout in his underwear with. Fantastic. I'd read that, you know, one critic had gone and described that Mac's vocal delivery was lethargic. I don't know, I'd say lethargic is too strong a term, but it is, I don't know, casual? Is that the word you'd use?
Yeah, I think it almost has, it's tough to articulate some of the stuff. I want to say it is, when I say, I'm struggling to find the right descriptive here, I would say almost lazy, but lazy is, it sounds like a negative thing. I think there's a very, I don't know if, I'm finding it hard, but I think a word in that realm certainly describes it, because there's never aggressive feel. Yeah, like you said, laid back a little bit, and the way he kind of has a very, very relaxed kind of croon at times, and his delivery is very unique.
Word, these songs, they're a long way removed from apathy. But so I guess the word that I'm going to stick with is casual. These songs there, I guess, maybe another good word would be meandering, because these songs are, in some ways, they're meandering thoughts on family, which is not always flattering, love, and, you know, maybe bored suburban life, but not sort of in a fist pumping declaration of, I've got to get out of this place if it's the last thing I ever do. It's just, it's, almost resignation. I don't know. Would you say that's a fair assessment?
In some way, I would say that's a fair assessment. I think to me, what it sounds like is an album that was recorded at 3 or 4 in the morning by himself a lot. Because I do feel like, you know, like we talked about, there are the themes of growing up in suburbia and love and longing and there's this David Lynchian thing of familial and suburban sort of malaise and discontent and something darker going on beneath the veneer of the white picket fence.
Yep.
None of it is done in a heavy-handed way, but I find him to be a really, really talented songwriter in the way he crafts his songs. There's a bit of a slyness, but also very much a fragility at times. And there's very, to me, he has a very keen sense of observation to sort of life and love. And
yes,
it's very poetic.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I found it interesting that you sort of made the David Lynch reference there, because he manages to blend this sort of cheeky humor. Gosh, I never thought I'd use the word cheeky on this show. I don't think I ever use that word, but it really is sort of like he's not the Messiah. He's a very naughty boy. It's a sort of cheeky sense of humor, but the Lynch element is that there's something dark going on behind that picket fence. And we mentioned before Ode to Viceroy, and he obviously has a love of the cancer stick.
Viceroy, early in the morning, just trying to let the sun in and open up my eyes.
Song in the film clip, which we'll get into shortly, has singing skeletons and smoke belching up to the sky. And which way is he taking this? But I sort of see in some way, I thought, two bands I want to compare them to because of that sense of humor are the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band, more in terms of attitude. But also musically, as well, in terms of attitude, would be Ween. I don't know. Do you see a Ween comparison?
See, I do. Now, here's the funny thing about Ween. I don't want to step on anyone's toes here. Yeah, right. I think Ween is a group that I admire and I respect more than I like. Uh-huh. I don't know what it is. If I caught them at the wrong time, every time I tried to get into them, but they just always seem to grate on me. Not great on me. That sounds a bit harsh, certainly. They never quite worked for me the way that on paper I thought they would. But it's funny because Mac is very much a kindred spirit to Ween, certainly. So it's very, it's very strange. I'll have to maybe go back and reassess my lukewarm feelings on Ween because I adore Mac.
I mean, look, I know that some people have gone and accused Ween maybe of... I don't know, maybe try too hard is not the right expression, but maybe they're trying to be clever, whereas
yes.
I think Mac is, I guess, a lot more natural in his approaches. He sounds like, well, what you went and said, like, he's recording at 3 a.m. in his underwear, and I suspect he's probably had a night with a little bit of the weed, and this is just what's coming out, and that's why he sounds so laconic and laid back with his delivery. Actually, while we're on the drug train over here, the opening song on the album is called "Cooking Up Something Good."
He's in the kitchen, cooking up something good. And Daddy's on the sofa, pride of the neighborhood. My brother's in the ballet. And I'll be up at midnight with my cigarette. Oh, when life moves this slowly. Oh, just try to let it go.
this, you know, this tale, this very bizarre tale from the perspective of a teenager, you know, living in the suburbs, and his father's in the basement cooking up something good. I've gone and nicknamed this song Walter White Song, because I imagine that, you know, his father's in the basement doing the crystal meth. And yet, even in this sort of, you know, humorous song, I think, you know, he's just also singing about, oh, yeah, my brother takes ballet, and he's living this very dysfunctional family life. And yet there's that dark moment where he sings, ooh, when life moves this slowly, just try and let it go. So he's still very aware, you know, that he's not necessarily happy with his life. You know, nothing seems to be happening for him. So he's gonna make this humorous observation along with, we mentioned the word resignation before, and it's sort of interesting how we can combine both the humor and the dark element within that one song, and that's a general theme for the album.
It is, and there's very much an awareness of an intelligence, but an awareness of his resignation. And I think that it's interesting how a lot of his songs kind of open almost like I feel like he revels in sort of anti-vanity, and he revels in sort of awkward moments.
Yes, yes, good point.
Which, you know, I think I've seen him, and he's very much the antithesis of sort of a glam rocker, although his early work is very much influenced by glam rock. I just, like I said, even his album cover is so no frills, and it's very awkward in some ways, but it's this awkward aesthetic that works quite well, and his, like, the album opens with that track, and it's one of my favorite tracks. It's hard to pick. It's like my children, you know, it's, you know, you can't pick just one. And it's very, like, the guitar is very sort of warbly, and it's slightly off kilter. And I think that is very reflective of him and his sound, is things are very sort of off kilter, but it sounds almost there. It's just a little bit off. And yeah, I love that line. Mommy's in the kitchen cooking up something good. Daddy's on the sofa, pride of the neighborhood.
Yes.
And it starts out very much like this innocent suburban song about this teenage boy who's up at night, but then, like you said, it goes into something much darker where the father is cooking meth in the basement, and his brother's slinging it in the suburbs.
That's right, yeah.
He kind of slips it in there. It's very subversive.
One thing that we've been talking about him as a songwriter and as this guy with a sense of humor, but let's talk a little bit about the sort of musical approach here on the album. Well, so there are two things that stick out, I guess. The guitar, you've already sort of gone and used, you know, that word sort of has a warbly sort of sound. The word that came to my mind was shimmering.
And yeah, definitely.
I know it's not necessarily a very technical musical description, but hopefully that sort of conveys to someone who hasn't heard the music yet what this album sound is like. And it's sort of, you were speaking before while we were talking about Michael Kiwanuka, about his music sounding to you like a great autumn day, but the sort of shimmering, very bright sort of sound that he has from his guitar on this album reminds me a little bit like, I don't know how familiar you are with Australian songwriter Paul Kelly, but he has this great song called He has this great song, probably one of my very favorite Kelly songs, called How to Make Gravy. And it has this great sort of summer guitar. There's this sort of up and down slide motif that they use throughout this. And it's conveyed there. Probably another good comparison. It's not necessarily a song I like, but I do like the guitar feel on it. You hear in the lead guitar on I think it's America, their song Sister Golden Hair. I like the sound.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think that's the guitar sound that he's going for here. The other thing, I guess, that is evident about this album, and we've already gone and said that he's got like a very laid back, very laconic sort of sound for this album, and yet rhythmically, because I mean, it's him doing all the instruments on this, right?
I believe so. I know he tours with the band, obviously.
Yeah, yeah, but I think it's all him doing the instrumentation. So, I mean, the bass playing and drumming on this, it's what musicians like to call tight but loose, you know. So it sounds like everything's in place, but not anally so. It's, you know, it's not sounding like perfect because we have to get this sounding perfect. It's great because everything is in its place, but it sounds more like he's doing it naturally, like breathing. And, you know, the rhythm, well, it's all him, but, you know, the rhythm section, if you want to call it that, he sets up a groove. It's a groove-based record. I mean, that's not to say that, you know, these songs aren't well crafted. They are, but the songs are more groove based rather than, I guess, based on trying to sort of develop melodies. Once again, the good melodies are great melodies even, but I think he's more going for the groove here. And that's, you know, before you sort of like get to the dark tones of the lyrics and themes and what he's trying to get at here, that's, I guess, musically what I take away from it.
Absolutely. No, I would agree with that wholeheartedly. It is very much a tight but loose sound. But it really does, again, it's one of those things where I was really stunned. I knew Mac was young. I think he's 23 or 24. And it's that thing again of, you know what is an interesting through line, Morris, now that I think about it, is the distinct lack of vanity on both of our artists, with both of our artists this week. You know, they may be very different musically, but there's a distinct lack of vanity on both sides. With Mac, I think again he's a little more playful and he can have sort of a faux vanity, or you know, just for the sake of vanity, just because it's very absurd and silly. But he's very, like I said, anti-vanity. So I think it's interesting. And,
sure.
and with
well,
his
I mean-
sound, he's
well, those film clips that you see, you know, for Ode to Viceroy and my kind of woman, you know, he's really taking the Mickey out of himself. There, this is not a
yeah,
guy
very
who
much.
He's not trying to sort of show himself to the world in the best light. It's more like, you know, hey, I'm having a laugh at myself. You'll have a laugh with me too. And I'd love to have seen him live. I really would, because I imagine he's probably a, you know, very very funny guy. Not just
yeah.
a planned visual sense on his film clips. I'm sure he's got a lot of interesting and funny things to say. That's the other thing with this album. He sort of seesaws between songs where he's, you know, got something really funny to say, and you know, songs like "Freaking Out the Neighborhood" or "Ode to Viceroy," or you know, "My Kind of Woman." Really, you know, has its funny moments, or I guess maybe a little bit detached. In some ways, but then you get songs like, you know, the album closes "Still Together."
In time she'll see that her and me were meant to be together, and time will pass, it may go fast, but we'll still be together. And where I go, she's at my side, half of my life together. It's easy love, it's like a glove, from up above together. Together.
The song that sounds the least like anything else on the album, that's just him and,
yes.
and an acoustic guitar doing this sort of reggae rhythm, and yeah. whereas the rest of it sort of has this, I don't know, I guess something, and I don't mean this to sound negative, but it's something that came to mind, is some of the songs sound almost like he's a Las Vegas performer, but, or maybe he's taken the piss
yeah.
out of a Las Vegas performer. I made a note that on the song "Freaking Out the Neighborhood," which had like a sort of a disco-y feel, it made me think like it belonged in a disco scene in a movie. And I'm not talking about like something like Saturday Night Fever. It sounds to me like it belongs. It sounds like it belongs in that scene in The Jerk.
Sorry, Mama, there are times I get carried away. Please don't worry. Next time I'm home, I'll still be the same. And I know it's no fun when you're first son gets up to no good, starts freaking out the neighborhood. Really.
Steve Martin, spoiler alert, realizes that his invention has wrecked a lot of people's lives, and he's got this big disco scene. He's going to hide all these people to dance away the night in his room. It sounds like it belongs there. It's just sort of corny, kitschy, Las Vegas-y disco thing. It really sounds like it belongs there.
It's so funny that that was evocative for you in that way, because, and I'm not lying to you, I've always thought this, and I can't quite place why. That the opening of Freaking Out the Neighborhood to me is very evocative. I don't know why. This is going to sound so silly to say, but it has a very much to me like a 1983 Australian kind of late at night bar sound. Completely off the mark, but there's a sound very much of that time, like 83. I don't know why I associated it with Australia. Maybe it had been a, sort of a guitar riff I'd heard from an Australian band of the time, and I've kind of tied them in my head together subconsciously and can't quite place why, but it has very much that kind of sound. And it's funny that you've got sort of this disco sound. I'm gonna have to go back and re-listen, because it's definitely one of my favorite tracks on the album.
Go back
and it's so well written.
Go back and watch The Jerk and play that song while you're watching that scene and see if it works. Now I've already gone and mentioned a couple of times about Ode to Viceroy, and I don't know, I just have a feeling that it's the sort of song that if he was still around, Frank Zappa would dig.
Yeah, good call.
It's quite ironic, considering that here in Melbourne at the moment, we've got at Acme down here, we've got an exhibition that discusses the history of the music video clip. I wouldn't say necessarily a love-hate relationship with the music video clip, but I get a bit wary when a song is permeated into my brain more for the video clip than rather than its own merits. And because this video clip is so bizarre and it's the first way I encountered this song, I'm still uncertain as to... Well, I mean, I do love the song, but I listen to it now and all I think of is that video clip and seeing him sort of walk in that keep on trucking sort of way, you know, with that cigarette dangling from his lips and this guitar held up very high on his chest. And I have nothing to add to that conversation, you know, that millions of people have added about a video clip can justifiably add something artistically to the song, or it's just a vehicle for selling the song. Really, I now listen to that song and I just think of that video clip, and you know, it's laid back feel, and you know, he's walking down the street, and yeah, it's all very cool and very casual.
It's funny, yeah, how he does that with the videos of his, like with My Kind of Woman. It feels, again, to me, he feels very much to me like an artist. I know he said, like, some of the stuff he really loves is, like, Steely Dan and stuff like that, which I think on the surface you maybe wouldn't catch, but I think some of the more subversive kind of... See, he has at times, you know, Steely Dan and groups like that that had sort of a sunny sort of AM radio sound, but below that, if you listen to what they were writing, it had a darker side to it.
Yes, yes.
So I think that's very interesting, certainly when I think about him. But with My Kind of Woman, it almost feels like if it wasn't this, you know, ridiculous gap-toothed young man, the way sort of early 80s music videos were overlit and there was a very obvious air of artificiality, it feels like that. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, yes, yes.
Like if you look at like Taco putting on the Ritz or things like that, they're just starkly lit. And, you know, it seems to kind of be you know, in line with that.
Knows when it's me, knows how I'm feeling, and gives me a healing. Oh, Annie, sit down beside me, let me confide in. You know when I'm lonely, and honey, I'm lonely. I'm going down.
Song like Annie, which, you know, on the surface sounds a bit like a love song, but that's really dark subject matter there. You know, he declares he's going down, and you sort of wonder really where his head is at.
That's an interesting track. There's a few songs on the album named for women. There's Cheryl and there's Annie.
Right.
Annie's an interesting track because it almost has this kind of underwatery psychedelic feel at times, and it it hits some high notes in this, and I wrestle with who I think Annie is. Is Annie a friend, a girlfriend? Is it his sister? The way he refers to Daddy, not to say my daddy, but Daddy won't let me. I wonder about the context of relationship in that, which I think is something I see throughout the album.
I hadn't actually sort of thought of that, but that is open to interpretation. I know that your time is limited, so last song I guess I wanted to make any reference to, we've already sort of mentioned by name Still Together, the last song, which has more of a folky singer-songwriter element on it, and it's you know, got this cool little almost reggae feel, and he does this sort of a falsetto melody in the middle. Tell me, did that sound like he was ripping off the line Sleeps Tonight to you?
I'd never thought of that, but it does seem in line with that statement. It's funny because that's sort of like, it is very different than the other songs on the album. It's not to say this stuff isn't sweet. This stuff's more about longing and observation, but this feels very surface sweet, acoustic. There's no greasy electric guitar. It's simple yet effective, and it's in fact very sort of deceptively simple, much like The Lion Sleeps Tonight. So yeah.
So I mean, look, after listening to this, and really, I think we've probably spoken longer about the album than the album actually goes for. It's only like a thing of 31
minute album.
But like Michael Kiwanuka, I'm looking forward to see where he goes with this. I mean, we've already sort of got a bit of a taste today. The post I put up, so what they call like a teaser. I'm sure it's not a track that's going to be on the album, but has some naked guy. I'll put this up on the page. But some naked
on silver and gold. If it's a naked guy.
Oh man, yeah, that's exactly where we're going to put it. Guy, just a guitar covering him up, and he's singing in that Las Vegas disco-y type of sound, singing about "Got to get me some pussy, got to get me some pussy." Definitely very silver and golden. I wonder if he ever finds his cat.
Kiki. And a lot of his songs, just to quickly jump in, a lot of his songs have these kind of non sequitur endings, which I kind of like. It gives it this lens of this air of very bizarre kind of left field, which is cool.
So I want to know whether that ending on Still Together, do you think that's genuine, or is he playing with us again? You know, like he's playing.
I think
he finished the song, and he's saying, "What are you doing up? What happened? What are you doing?" I think, is that really recorded in his bedroom? Is that really? But I
think
know.
It stems maybe from an original place. It's tough to say, and that's the thing I love about him, is how much he revels in the awkward. Like, is this like he'll linger in the moment, and he lingers in that moment, whether it stems from an original place or not. It's certainly up for discussion, but it makes for interesting listening.
Oh well, overall, it's really a cool little album, and it doesn't outstay its welcome. I think he's got some great compositions on there. I guess probably the only minor criticism that I'd have is I'd like to see him sort of vary it up maybe on the next album with his guitar sound, as much as I like it.
Sure.
I guess maybe, you know, after a while you sort of think, well, that there's that jangly sound again. I'd like to see him sort of mix it up a little bit more. But anyway, we'll see where he goes with that. That'll be album number 3, I think, next time, won't it?
Yeah, he's only been making music for about 5 or 6 years, so I think it really indicates how talented he is. And I may have already said this, but in case I don't get the opportunity to again, I hope everyone checks out both albums. But this album, it was my favorite album of last year. I listened to it front to back all the time.
Nice.
Really, really hope people check out Mac, because he's really something.
I think he'll be around for a long while. I really do. All right, look, I think that's pretty much what we have to say about Mac. And I know that you have to start your working day. So, look, basically at this point, I just want to say thank you immensely for joining me on the show. It's been an absolute pleasure, and I'm really looking forward to when we can do this again.
Absolutely. It really has been a pleasure, Morris, and it's been nice to talk about music, because I feel like I don't get enough time to look at music, which I love, certainly, as critically as I'd like. It tends to be more as I'm moving around or as I'm doing something. Certainly not white noise. I would never relegate it to that status, but I don't get to really sit down and really listen to and toss around in my head, I think, what maybe the intent or the themes are sometimes. So this afforded me that opportunity. So thank you to you for that.
Oh, well, I'll have to, so basically if I keep inviting you on, I'll be doing you a favor. So I have to look after you, Will. I have to look after you.
You do.
all right. So I'll just very quickly, a couple of housekeeping things. So Love That Album episode 58 will be out in a month. So basically, yep, I'm reducing the number of episodes that I do from now on. Not because I'm getting lazy, but if you've been reading the Facebook posts, you'd know that I've started up a second podcasting venture because, you know, I've got all the spare time on my hands. Not. My good friends Wendy and Tim and I got together to do a bonus episode of Silver and Gold late last year, covering a couple of music-related films. And we had so much fun doing it, we decided we'd keep doing that in our own right. So we've gone and started up a podcast called See Here. That's S-E-E-H-E-A-R, See Here Podcast. And every month we're going to cover one music-related film. And it can be a documentary, it can be a narrative. We just sort of thought, there's a lot of great film podcasts, but there wasn't anyone who was tackling that specifically. So we thought, well, there you go, we've got a niche. Episode one has been up for a couple of weeks, and it was Tim's choice. We discussed Hated, the film about Gigi Allen, punk singer and all-round interesting fellow, I think is, you know, probably the polite way to call him. But we had a fascinating discussion about that. And see, the other beautiful thing about discussing music-related films is it exposes me to music I might not otherwise listen to, or artists I might not otherwise listen to. And I think for a music-related film, you don't have to like the music, just as long as there's an interesting story to tell. One thing you couldn't say about Gigi Allen is that he didn't have an interesting story. It's fascinating. The film is on YouTube if you want to search it out. Hated, the Gigi Allen and the Murder Junkies. It's not long. I think only about like a 55-minute film. So search that out there. And the next episode will be on sometime, I think mid-February, we'll be talking Wendy's choice, which is, ladies and gentlemen, The Fabulous Stains.
Nice.
So I haven't seen that one yet, but I've acquired it. So looking forward to talking about that in February. But the next episode of Love That Album, so basically every couple of weeks we'll be See Here, and then a couple of weeks Love That Album. So basically I'll still be involved in two podcasts a month, which is the good news if you like what I'm involved in. And the bad news is, if you don't like it, is I'll be doing two podcasts a month. I Love That Album episode 58. We'll finally see, hopefully, technical problems free. And we've sort of proven this over the last few weeks. Jeff Smith will be returning along with John Stewart from Sydney. And to celebrate the fact that Bruce Springsteen is coming back to Australia, he's after spending years and years away, he's coming back twice within the space of a year to promote his new album, High Hopes. So we'll be discussing that. And normally, like the last few shows, we've been talking about albums in a fairly general sort of vein, but I think just for that show, we'll be doing on a song-by-song basis. We'll see how we go anyway. But we'll be talking about that in a few weeks, and Jeff no doubt will have something to say because, both Jeff and John will be seeing Bruce. This will be the first Springsteen tour of Australia I'll be missing, but at those ridiculous prices and the fact that last time when I went to see him, I saw the wrong show and he did all the Born in the USA material, which I don't like. I thought, well, I'm not taking a chance this time. But I must say, Tom Morello was outstanding, and I guess he'd be worth it if I went. But anyway, never mind. So Bruce Springsteen, High Hopes, will be discussed with the Bruce Springsteen Appreciation Club. I love that album, so listen out for that. I think that's all just about. If you've been enjoying the show, or you want to find the show, you can find Love That Album on lovethatalbum.blogspot.com. Love That Album on iTunes. Search for it there. Please let your friends know that we exist. I love getting new listeners to the show, partly because it does my ego some good knowing that someone is out there actually listening. But, you know, just it's nice to be able to share with potentially new people to speak to on the show. Always looking to have new potential conversationalists who'll put me onto new great music and stuff that we can share. It's always good in that regard. So please let people out there know that a podcast discussing about music actually exists. And also a big shout out to another great music podcast. They've only released episode zero, but they'll be recording hopefully in the next few days, is our good friend John Ross. He of the Feed My Ears Facebook page. Feed My Ears is now a podcast. So between John, Nathan and Jeff, they've done an episode zero, getting to know you sort of thing. Give a lot of support to John and his Feed My Ears podcast, because we need more music podcasts out there. And the first episode that they put out was very, very entertaining. So I think that pretty much covers it. I'll let you go to work, sir.
Thank you. And I do want to wish Maurizio Guarini of Goblin fame a very, very happy 59th birthday.
Oh, wow. Wow. I did not know that. Fantastic.
He lives about 45 minutes from me.
You're going to knock on his door and give him a birthday cake.
Yeah, I would love to. But they're touring, which is good, which is a good thing. I had a chance to see them in the fall with dear friend Chris Brown, the Uncool Cat. So,
oh, man,
yeah, but other than that.
You'll have a great time. I got to see them back in July here.
Oh, I did. Yeah, I did see them in October.
Ah, right. Yep.
So
yep.
It was a good show.
It was fantastic. Getting to see all the film clips in the background. It was just, it was brilliant. And just, I guess, is one more quick word. I listened to in the last week an older episode of The Projection Booth, which I think is an absolute stellar podcast. And they did an episode on Deep Red. They had an interview with Claudio Simonetti. Talking about his recollections of recording the music for Deep Red and for Dario Argento in general. And he's just a wonderful guy to listen to. He was absolutely fascinating. So obviously, if you're an Argento fan, you want to listen to that episode. But if you're particularly a Goblin fan, then download that and hear what Claudio has to say. Anyway, I'll let you get to work, sir. Thanks very much for joining me on Love That Album. And thank you, listeners out there, for downloading. And we'll be back in a few weeks with Love That Album 58 and back in shorter time with the See Here podcast. Until then, stay nice to each other, listen to some great music, read some good books, watch lots of great films, and we'll speak to you soon. Cheers.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune in to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.